This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. Coming up, WMUK's Gordon Evans talks to Raia Raga, a former Al Jazeera reporter who is now with Amnesty International. She'll be part of a panel discussion on the media this weekend for Great Lakes Peace Jam at Western Michigan University. But first, we hear how the Kalamazoo Area United Way is using screenings of a highly celebrated documentary to spark community conversation about the need to treat childhood trauma. The film highlights the foundings of a groundbreaking federal study that shows adverse childhood experiences, called ACEs for short, can alter the brain, leading to learning but also mental and physical health issues. To tell us more about the local awareness campaign, we're joined today by Jennifer Nottingham, Associate Director of Community Impact at the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo Region, and Diane Marquez, Director of Behavioral Services at Family and Children's Services. Welcome to WMUK.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're getting ready to show a film in Kalamazoo. It's called Resilience, The Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope. What is that film about?
The film reviews a seminal study done by Dr. Floody and Dr. Anda that was done in the mid-1990s that assessed the childhood experiences of over 17,000 individuals. And it looks specifically at what those adverse childhood experiences were and then how that affected life outcomes for those individuals. The five adverse childhood experiences that it examines are substance abuse, parental divorce, mental illness, whether or not there was domestic abuse, if there's an incarcerated parent, physical, sexual, or psychological abuse, and then physical and emotional neglect. What is the long-term impact of those on us? And then it talks about not just what the impact is, but what can we do about it? And the results of the study were pretty startling. I think what the film does uniquely is that it makes potentially very complicated information extremely accessible.
And the shorthand word for adverse childhood experiences, people may hear it throughout this conversation today, is ACEs.
Yes.
The study was done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente. Mm-hmm. Permanente. That's a nonprofit healthcare provider based in California. What is the importance of knowing ACEs?
Several things. First of all, ACEs are very common. 66%, about two-thirds, identified as having at least one ACE. The other thing that we learned was that if you have one ACE, it's very likely that you have two or more. 87% of those individuals had two or more ACEs. Those ACEs, the more you have, the more challenged you are with a lot of life outcomes. So when you are comparing, for example, someone with no ACEs to someone with four ACEs, someone with four ACEs is twice as likely to be a smoker, seven times more likely to be an alcoholic, four times more likely to have lung cancer, three times as likely to have any kind of cancer, and 12 times more likely to attempt to commit suicide. You get up into the really high numbers. If you have six or more ACEs, that can cut 20 years off the person's lifespan. So it was one of the most remarkable and profound discoveries in public health that we've had in a long time, because what we've discovered is that adverse childhood experiences undercut almost every physical, social, mental, and emotional problem that we experience as a society.
Now, let's talk about the brain science behind that. What does childhood trauma do to the brain?
So you're familiar with fight or flight. Most of us are. That is the physiological response that our body has when there is a perceived threat. The amygdala takes a look at the environment, scans for a threat, and makes a decision about whether or not something is threatening or not. This was designed as a survival mechanism. The body is actually only designed to be in fight or flight mode for about 20 minutes. And it's supposed to help us decide whether or not, if there is a lion, tiger, or bear, or something threatening around, make that decision to run away or fight it. And in response to that, the hypothalamus gets activated and we have the sympathetic nervous system goes online. The body is flooded with cortisol and adrenaline, and we make that decision. The problem is that when we are under prolonged periods of stress, those experiences are there not just for that 20 minutes, but for very long periods of time, and it has a profound impact on the brain and our DNA.
So what it can do is those stress hormones actually have an influence on our cells, our chemicals, and the wiring of our brain. So they sculpt the brain for certain characteristics. So if you have those stress hormones released all the time, then you're going to have characteristics of being edgy, hot-tempered, impulsive, hypervigilant, or you could be withdrawn, dissociated, or numb. Now compare that to someone who doesn't have those stress hormones being put into their brain all the time. That person, their wiring and their chemistry of their brain allows them to be more focused, flexible, and relationship oriented.
So we can get a sense of the scope of this problem. Some people may say, maybe that's not me. In the general population, what percentage of people would have ACEs?
In Michigan, it's about 64%, so close to two-thirds. It's very similar to what the national study would indicate. So about two-thirds of individuals have at least one ACE.
This study was done in the mid-90s. What's giving it some momentum right now? Why are we talking about this now?
As a movement, a lot of people actually have been talking about trauma for 15, 20 years. And you'll get some experienced professionals in the mental health field that'll be like, this isn't new to us. We've known about this. I think what's new is that we're having videos like Resilience make it more accessible to the average layperson. Whereas before it used to be sort of a mental health issue and that's all the people that were talking about it. Now everybody recognizes that this isn't them. This is us. This is all of us. And we need to do something about it.
I think also, too, we've been talking a lot more recently about integrated health. So as Jennifer had referenced, we are looking at both the physical and the mental health of a person. So we can't just, you know, take care of the body from the neck down and keep the head separate. That's been a movement that's been happening for quite some time, too, but hopefully catching on more. And I think, as Jennifer said, we're connecting the two. So people who have these traumatic experiences may be more likely to have an anxiety disorder, but they're also more likely to have a cardiovascular disease or allergies or asthma. And I think sometimes when you put those two together, it can be more relatable instead of compartmentalizing them.
Let's talk about how you're trying to wrap your arms around that locally. You have a work committee called Raising Kalamazoo County. You've mm-hmm. been meeting for a couple of years now. Can you tell us about how that transformed into what you're doing now?
Sure. It was actually in fall of 2015 that we offered a screening of a movie called The Raising of America. And it was all about early childhood and how important experiences in early childhood are. When we looked at the evaluation data, the place that everybody wanted to focus on to influence and improve early childhood outcomes was policy. But policy is really big. And so the next question we asked was, where in policy do you want to focus? And given all of this energy around trauma and toxic stress and building resilience, that particular issue was identified overwhelmingly by the group. The work group has two goals. One is around raising awareness about the issue through things like the documentary screening and having conversations about that, as well as helping the organizations that see that and now are very interested in becoming trauma-informed, putting resources in place to support that, as well as coordinating and increasing communication and collaboration among the organizations that are committed to that. So those are the two goals of the work group.
You're listening to WMUK's West Southwest. We're talking to Jennifer Nottingham from the United Way of the Battle Creek in Kalamazoo region and Diane Marquez from Family and Children's Services about the United Way-led public awareness campaign about the harmful effects of adverse child experiences, called ACEs for short. United Way has been hosting public screenings of the documentary Resilience, The Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope. We continue the conversation with the United Way's Miss Nottingham, talking about the two screenings that's been held in Kalamazoo to date and the one planned for Tuesday, November 14th at WMU's Medical School.
But we plan on having lots more screenings because what we know is that collectively, if we're going to address this issue as a community, everybody needs to know about it. So we can't do a few screenings and then assume that we're done. We have to keep on raising awareness until we reach a tipping point and everybody's talking about
it. And the general public is invited to any of these and it's free.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd like to talk solutions. I know that when it comes to reversing the harm of childhood trauma, it's been shown that one caring adult can make a difference. What other things can be done and what's being done locally?
So kind of looking at different ways that we can hopefully prevent or reduce the incidence of people experiencing trauma, you can look at it as we need to have three protective systems. So one of them is the individual themselves and what their capabilities are. The second one would be, as you referenced, an attachment and belonging with a person who's caring and competent. So that's why these awareness showings and raising that is important as well, too. So caring is being one thing, but we also need people to be competent about what's happening to individuals as well. And then the third thing is having that protective community. So having the community as a whole being a place where we can support and encourage people. So those are different things that we can do. Something that's been around a long time also has been a program called, it's a philosophy of strengthening families. And there are five protective factors for families and for children. And that would be, one of them would be having a social and emotional competence of children. So we're helping children create those. That parents have knowledge of parenting and child development so they can support their children the best way they can. That they have social connections. That they have concrete support in times of need. And that we are supporting parental resilience. So we're kind of helping build that. So if we do all of those types of things, we can helpfully create that environment that's going to be preventative.
Students that have in their background several ACEs, they get suspended more often. And what does this look like in the school system? I'm reading, you know, having problems paying attention.
What's going on there, right? Like, what is that? How does that show up? And what can we do about it?
I guess the word I'm looking for, it's easy to throw kids away and think they're just bad kids.
So I think one thing to take a look at is that kind of how this trauma impacts people. What it does is that it impacts them, their cognition, their abilities to pay attention, and their social pieces. So all those go into play with kids in school. So if kids are having cognitive issues, trauma can cause diminished IQ, slowed language development. In one study, they talked about how kindergartners are scoring below average in reading and math when they've experienced trauma. So with that, then you have dropout or delinquency attached to that. And then with attention, they're three times more likely to have problems with paying attention if they've experienced trauma. And we know how that can impact school, as well as socially. They have difficulty with self-regulation, and that can lead to aggression and outburst, which can lead to suspensions and aggression at school too as well. So those are some of the things that we might see. So we need people to be aware that those are responses to trauma and not just willful behavior of children, so that we can address it differently and look at them differently.
I guess what's kind of scary to me about that in the school system is those are pathways to prison.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key paradigm shifts that the trauma-informed building resilience movement encourages is changing the paradigm from asking the question, this includes educators, but it includes all of us, from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And so, and then understanding that somebody's experiences then affects their behaviors and their life choices. So that knowledge, that awareness then, of understanding that oftentimes people are very much almost unwillingly, especially kids, you know, engaging in behaviors over which they have very little control. They don't know why they're lashing out or why they're exploding in the classroom. But helping teachers understand what's going on and then giving teachers and educators and other individuals that work with kids the tools to respond to that appropriately, that's a really important part of this work.
And I understand that a part of your work that you're doing now is trying to get local trainers. What is that? Local trainers in what? And to whom would they provide this training?
So we have been working with the Michigan ACEs Initiative to develop a cadre of local trainers that will be able to provide additional support about what trauma is and how to create trauma-informed environments, responding to trauma, understanding trauma. Those trainers are actually going to be able to train other trainers. That's our long-term vision. But for now, those individuals are raising awareness about it. So we are working on those kinds of trainers. We also are lucky enough to have a few different organizations in our community that have already been training about trauma. We have the Children's Trauma Assessment Center. Family and Children's Services has done some training about what trauma is, as has Community Mental Health.
So these trainers would be training just the mental health community?
Anybody
who asks for it?
Mm-hmm.
Would there be a charge for this training?
There is no charge.
Interesting.
And the training can be tailored to different groups, too. So the nice thing about how the ACE study and the training was laid out is that it can be a 20-minute presentation, very tailored. It could be a 3-hour showing of resilience and a discussion, and it can be tailored to the different groups. So depending on what your interest is and how you might be interacting with individuals or children or families, the training can be focused on what you would need to know.
Now, this particular showing is at the medical school. So those that are training to become physicians hopefully will attend this. So this is an issue that shows up in the doctor's office as well. What is it that they can do?
That's a complicated question.
I would think so.
And that's a question that a lot of physicians have asked. And when we've spoken with other physicians in the area that have been leading in this work, one of them is Dr. Leah Gugino. She's been working with us and talking to us about us and said, that's the question, right? It really, and Diane mentioned this earlier, is a compelling argument for an integrated model of care.
I do think, though, that in our society today, people are more likely to go to a physician first, maybe before seeking any type of mental health support. So I think it is important for physicians to be aware that some of the symptoms that their patients are telling them could be related to more of a mental health issue that could be worked on differently than just medicine alone. So a patient could come in saying that they're having difficulty sleeping, that they have a lack of an appetite, that they are feeling nervous or jumpy. So those are physical symptoms, but they're also symptoms of that trauma manifestation and some emotional issues that can be worked on through mental health supports.
There's a pediatrician that is featured in the particular film Resilience that you're showing, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, who's out of California, and she's a leader in this particular area. And if I heard correctly, I thought that what she was doing is routinely screening children who come in for ACEs. How popular is that work? Could you speak to that, Ms. Nottingham?
Sure. Medicaid actually in Michigan approved using the ACE screening tool as one way to assess incoming children. Not a lot of doctors do it yet, but some do, and they're permitted to do that. As a caution there, it isn't supposed to be actually given to the children to fill out themselves. It's supposed to be given to the adults to fill out on behalf of the child. But by understanding what an ACE score is, because a kid with an ACE score of 0 that shows behavior issues might require a very different kind of intervention than a kid with an ACE score of 6. You know, you're going to say, okay, so this kid probably requires really a medical intervention if you have an ACE score of 0. If your ACE score is 6, this child has some significant challenges in their life, and they're going to need comprehensive supports.
We've been talking to Jennifer Nottingham, Associate Director of Community Impact for the United Way of the Battle Creek and Kalamazoo Region, and Diane Marquez, Director of Behavioral Services at Family and Children's Services. For registration information to see a screening of the Resilience documentary coming up on November 14th and a second one now scheduled for December 11th at KRESA, visit WMUK.org. The film had its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival in 2016. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Rawi Araga is now a senior crisis advisor for Amnesty International. In that role, she has been investigating war crimes and human rights issues. Before that, she was a journalist for 15 years, including a stint with Al Jazeera English. Raga is the keynote speaker for Great Lakes Peace Jam this weekend at Western Michigan University. She will be part of a panel discussion at the Bernhard Center on Saturday. Actually, we'll both be part of it because I'm the moderator. It's called Fake News, Falsehoods, and Bigotry, and What Can Be Done. Rawi Araga joins us via Skype. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Gordon.
So let's step back and talk about your previous career. What got you into journalism in the first place?
So I've always known that I wanted to be a journalist ever since I was 13. There was just something about it that gave me a sense of excitement. You know, my name, Rawia, in Arabic actually means storyteller, and some of my friends always joke that I was kind of fated to do that. But I always had this rush of blood when I watched American television shows and saw the environment in the newsrooms, and the idea of being able to tell people stories and have that direct interaction with the public was really at the heart of why I wanted to do what I was doing for so long.
And Al Jazeera had you actually in Egypt during some very tumultuous times. Can you kind of condense for us just a little bit? I'm sure we could probably spend the next 40 minutes talking about it, but can you give us maybe the briefest description possible of what it was like to be there?
Sure. Covering the Egyptian uprising was really perhaps the most momentous juncture in my career as a journalist. I had been a journalist for a long time prior to the uprising. I had covered conflict in Iraq, in Darfur, in several parts of the world, and I had covered the growing calls within my own country for greater freedoms, the aspirations of young people for change. At that point, when the revolution happened, I was around 30 years old, and for my entire life, I had known only one president. So it was sort of this challenge to the status quo that was really invigorating to cover, not just as a journalist, but even as an Egyptian citizen to see it happen. After all, it was my generation that sort of sparked that uprising. So it was really an incredible story to cover. Now, some argue it didn't necessarily end a happy ending, and in general, the history of revolutions don't end particularly on a happy note, but it was definitely a very interesting moment to see a president of 30 years step down after mass protests across the country. The country is still at a difficult time trying to grapple with the aftermath of that uprising years later. Perhaps it finds its way, perhaps not, but it was certainly a huge story to cover and an incredible honor to witness that history as it unfolded.
Did you ever fear for your safety?
Absolutely. I mean, there were many times during covering the uprising where my crew and I had close calls with multiple people who wanted us to, you know, not to stop doing what we were doing, be it different government agencies, security members of the security forces, or even thugs or people of differing political views who did not want a certain narrative to be or the story to be told and wanted to impose a certain narrative. I can think of several occasions where we had dangerous brushes within Tahrir Square or outside the square across the country. But like many Egyptians who were part of that uprising, it was sort of an overwhelming moment that in the grand scheme of things, the memories of those brushes really pale.
Do you think that that coverage of the Arab Spring changed the way that social media was used to cover the news? And if some of those changes lasted beyond that?
Sure. I mean, there was definitely a lot of talk about how social media contributed during the Arab uprisings to spreading the call for protests, to mobilizing the public. And there were so many debates whether the uprisings could have happened with or without the social media platforms that enabled them. And frankly, I would always argue that it was the people, the masses who made these uprisings happen, not necessarily the social media platforms. In the aftermath of the uprisings, of course, as activists and citizen journalists continue to use social media, that forced journalists to find ways to learn more about verification of reports on social media. And you heard about issues like fake news even dating back then. It's a big issue in America now, but even back then, there was a lot of questions about material that was posted on social media. So definitely journalists had to educate themselves on how to verify certain accounts on social media. And that was sort of one of the things that came out from the Arab uprisings.
Let's talk a little bit more about fake news in a moment. But first, I want to ask you about what took you from the world of journalism to Amnesty International.
After I moved to the United States with my family, I sort of was looking into what to do next after moving on from Al Jazeera English. And this opportunity with Amnesty International presented itself. And what I do is very much in line with the same skills that I used as a journalist. What we do at Amnesty International is essentially investigate and expose facts when abuses happen. So I'm essentially using the same skills I used as a journalist to interview people, to tell their stories, to document violations. Now, what's different about my role with Amnesty is that is what we do with this documentation. So in journalism, our role was mainly to inform the public or to explain certain events. With Amnesty, we take it a step further. We take these findings, this research, and we try to lobby governments, try to lobby companies to change policy. And all of what we do has to be based in international law. So we have to be very careful and diligent and thorough about our documentation. And once again, as I said, the point is to try to campaign based on people's rights and try to influence policy in a positive manner.
As you know, people who go into journalism these days often worry about, you know, can they find a job? If they find a job, is the place they work at going to stay in business, or are there going to be cutbacks? Would you say that your experience might lead you to advise someone that if you learn very good journalism skills, that you can take them and use them in some ways that don't necessarily apply to the media?
So as far back as I can remember, journalism has been in this existential crisis. Is it going to last? Is it not going to last? You know, I started my career. When I started my career, it was around 2001, and I started with the Associated Press News Agency. And as a news agency, there were concerns that are newspapers going to survive? Will they be able to continue subscribing to news agencies or not? And what you saw really along the years is the news industry adapting and trying to evolve with sort of the demands of the market. And yes, the industry continues to be in peril. But two things. First of all, I think there will always be a need for journalists, and definitely there will always be a need for journalistic skills. The bread and butter of what we do is good reporting skills, good interviewing skills, listening to people, documentation, thoroughness, impartiality, good writing skills, and really communication skills is at the heart of it. And so if you really want to be a journalist and unfortunately you don't find a place for yourself in a newsroom, in a radio station or a television station, there will always be places where you can use these skills with different organizations, be it in the non-governmental world or in the corporate world.
So speaking of crises in the news media, where would you say that fake news falls there? Is it a real problem for the media itself, or is fake news more of a problem for people on the other end who are consuming news from whatever source they're getting it from?
So I don't know if you know, Gordon, but the Collins Dictionary just actually named fake news the word of the year. So now it's officially actually a word in our dictionaries, which is kind of interesting because there's nothing new about fake news. This goes back to like forever, basically. Now, of course, there's a lot of hysteria about it recently, and maybe it's not fair to call it hysteria because there are very legitimate concerns about fake news. We saw all the concerns about how it possibly undermined the U.S. elections. We saw the concerns about how it's being used to further demonize and target already marginalized minorities in the United States. And in fact, even outside Washington, we saw concerns about the deadly impact of fake news in places like Myanmar and South Sudan, where fake news is used to spread misinformation and target ethnic minorities. The results there are quite deadly, actually. But the important thing when looking at fake news, in my opinion, is to temper or be very careful about the way we handle it. First of all, we need to have a proper definition and not conflate fake news with sloppy journalism. And certainly we should not be using fake news to target legitimate journalism, legitimate critical journalism. On the other hand, when we try to look at how to deal with fake news, as a person who's now in the human rights world, it's very important for us to call for dealing with it with a human rights-based approach. In other words, not to go down that slippery slope of trying to restrict freedom of information under the banner of fighting fake news and propaganda. So these are all sort of concerns in trying to deal with fake news. And I know it's a lot of stuff to try to unpack in a short amount of time, but these are really just some of the concerns that come to my mind when addressing fake news.
Rawia Raga is a senior crisis advisor for Amnesty International. She's also a former journalist for Al Jazeera English. She joined us via Skype. Thank you very much for your time. Look forward to picking up the conversation on Saturday.
Thank you very much for having me.
Links with more information about Great Lakes Peace Jam and the panel discussion at the Bernhard Center on Saturday night can be found at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.